Hi, folks, and welcome to another episode of Rethinking with Alex Torpy. So this episode is a little bit different, actually very different than most of mine, but I wanted to share a few thoughts here. So this is largely related to some of the technology that we're seeing being developed around large language models and AI systems and things of that nature. As some of you may know, in 2021, I began writing some science fiction. These are what I would call hard sci-fi, meaning they are stories that are meant to be very realistic portrayals of where things might be going. And the books are meant to kind of play out a sort of pathway that I think is probable or possible, over the next decades and actually centuries. And so I started writing these books when I was living in New Jersey, sort of during COVID, and wrote a bulk of it while I was driving across the country in 2021. Since then, I've been working on editing and really trying to get to a point where I could publish one of them, which is somewhere around 100,000 words. And now there's a couple other books that are kind of part of the series, that same timeline. And what I wanted to do in this episode is just read one of the chapters that I have written here. This chapter is in the first book that I have been writing, which will most likely be the third from a timeline perspective in a series. And so this takes place about 100 years from now. The very short story is that there was sort of a continued degradation of globalized supply chains and governance models and economic systems that basically sort of broke a lot of the Western world in the 2040s and 2050s, and a very centralized, very efficient, very non-sort of individual agency government came out of that under something called Vision 2100. And so the time period that the chapter I'm about to read takes place about 100 years from now, around 2120. And this is in this sort of dystopian society where you have a very highly functional, highly efficient, highly organized national government, but there really is not a lot of individuality. And there are some much deeper problems that I'll save for when I actually finish the book. But I wanted to read this one chapter out because I wrote this in 2022 while, 2021, while driving across the country. So this is 5 years ago, and this is a sort of introduction to one of the characters in the book. And I think there's just some themes and ideas and concepts in here that are sort of relevant to think about as many of us are wondering and both interested in and both concerned about the direction that a lot of, you know, what we're calling AI technology is going in right now. So here's this chapter. It's obviously still quite in draft form, but hopefully it provides a few interesting insights into some of the things that we are sort of grappling with right now. In Cassandra Layton's normal day-to-day life, there was no one she took direction from. No one she didn't have veto power over, including, for the most part, the government itself, and almost certainly any official within that government in any sort of one-on-one encounter. She had amassed a considerable fortune and position of cultural importance by being the first person out of the gate with technology that could integrate live, biometric feedback into CGI-driven entertainment content. And because she already owned several streaming networks and had an aggressive go-to-market strategy, she was able to quickly and widely implement this technology to a nearly universal user base of hundreds of millions of people. Now, to put this in perspective, at one point in human history, mass media content basically flowed one way. It was produced by some number of people, and then that one media product was delivered to very large groups of people who then consumed it. The programming that people watched was optimized, but it was optimized over seasons and years, and the optimization not only came from the blunt measurement of medians of large sample sizes, but it was being fed back into producing a single end product that had to appeal to everyone at once, at least within any given particular media market. What many had been working on, but what Cass, as her relatively small group of close friends might call her, figured out how to do first was twofold, and ultimately resulted in the development of the most lucrative entertainment product on the planet, with far-reaching consequences that still hadn't finished playing out. Although much of the necessary biometric feedback hardware that could produce some insights based on things such as heart rate, galvanic skin response, blood glucose, and a few other indicators that already existed and was incorporated into most people's personal technology, the software, really the processing power and databases needed to accurately and quickly analyze those findings and produce some sort of reliable understandings of what people were actually thinking or feeling based on that kind of data was further behind. Basically, you could assess in real time, but it wouldn't be particularly accurate. And similarly, you could assess somewhat accurately, but it wasn't particularly real time. Now, Cass had been briefly involved in the medical field before turning to entertainment, and she was able to lean on some old connections to help connect some of the disparate dots. Her old friends were able to get her in the door with a couple of the largest private medical insurers and research hospitals, with whom she proposed a collaboration that all parties would find to become wildly successful. Her goal was to integrate their medical and insurance data with her existing behavioral and attitudinal data collected through her various entertainment delivery platforms. In exchange, she would sync some of her data, though her partners thought all of her data, to help them develop new insights in the medical field that would provide more accurate analysis of psychological issues in patient care and, more importantly, a stronger fiduciary outlook for shareholders. This data exchange symbiosis had a third party who was both a benefactor and a beneficiary, which was the government itself. Their aim and reason for nearly limitless financial support was to integrate all of these new develops and insights into their behavioral analysis programs deployed throughout their security apparatus. The collaboration seemed to be working in the way all parties were intending. On Cass's side, once her teams found more accurate, real-time ways to use all of this data to show a better play-by-play picture of what people were actually thinking or feeling about whatever content they were watching, or importantly, anything else they were doing, they were able to map these insights into the AI programs that produced much of the CGI entertainment content. Now, up until this point, there were still human actors, and sometimes, though less commonly, physical sets that were in use. Physical sets had become rare, though, because they were extremely expensive, and you were very limited in what you could do for a number of reasons, including the environmental waste produced from constructing and destroying large, expansive sets over and over again, plus all the other one-time uses of things that were needed to recreate many types of stories in the detailed ways that people had become used to. So by this point, most visual entertainment content in TV and movies was filmed with real people as actors, but with entirely computer-generated sets, costumes, and other features. Cass really just took this one step further and cut the human actors out altogether, replacing them with pixel-by-pixel designed characters that looked perfectly real, exactly matched what the content called for, didn't require salaries, and didn't have annoying agents or even more annoying contract writers. And in fact, Cass really went one step beyond that by cutting out much of the human producers and directors and almost every other of the incredibly numerous support positions that were previously required for live filming and production. Instead, she hired small groups of very smart and creative human writers who would create a world or storyline that would then get passed off to a set of AIs that had been programmed and trained at interpreting these frameworks and working together from different perspectives to build out complex and interesting stories. People found these AI-produced stories set on pixel-perfect backdrops endlessly engaging. And because it was so inexpensive to produce, an inconceivable amount of content was indeed produced. By connecting these two pieces successfully, her extreme data richness and the fully computer-generated entertainment production and delivery, she was able to create and distribute content that could actually react in real time to the feelings, attitudes, and beliefs of the people who were watching. It could alter visuals, music, dialogue, or even make small adjustments to subplots and stories and scenery about what people were watching to optimize their engagement with the content. And because advertisers paid for content on a per-minute basis, keeping the audience engaged was the first and really only priority. And what better way to do that than tell someone the story they want to hear? So this meant that people saw slightly different stories, or similar stories that played out in slightly different ways. And the development of these somewhat overlapping but somewhat divergent storylines in entertainment product delivery had several interesting effects. The first was the creation of a huge secondary and tertiary markets of engagement. Popular entertainment content that people used to watch together, or increasingly watch separately and then discuss together, was somewhat limited in that everyone saw the same thing. Yes, initially it was fun for everyone to share in the same experience together, but after a certain point, sharing reactions, whether in agreement or disagreement of one's take on whatever the same thing was that happened, hit a ceiling from an engagement perspective. But now it was different. There were not an infinite number of storylines, and people who had similar reactions and similar psychological profiles often saw similar but not identical storylines. But there was considerably more to discuss as people compared and debated and formed groups based around what they specifically saw. People were led to form intense, brief, and fluid social bonds with others who shared similar storyline experiences. It wasn't uncommon for groups of people to coalesce in storyline-specific VR meetups to talk about their shared experiences. This bond felt especially meaningful because there were your people, but there were also other people, those who didn't share one's own semi-unique storyline. This made it so that there was something personal and intimate and important feeling about bonding with those who you shared a storyline with. And then these close-knit groups of people who shared similar storyline experiences often discussed or debated with other groups who had different experiences. The groups would host discussions and panels and debates and other medias that got into little and big questions about why different storylines developed and which was better. Because people did not actually have access to the data or metadata, meaning they didn't actually know why they were shown a particular type of content, endless speculation and discussion ensued. This produced significant engagement, as people were not only talking about the content in ways that kept it on the front of one's mind for longer, but the discussions prompted various rewatching and sharing of clips that added to the engagement hours of the content being consumed and the advertising revenue generated from that. The dynamic of tightly bonded groups debating with each other led to another cascading effect from these divergent storyline experiences. The debates between storyline groups themselves became dramas playing out, but more in the way that being a fan of an athletic team might be, not in the way that political and social groups fought in the early millennia up to the breaking point. Meaning they were important to people, but most people knew ultimately that these were not serious enough divisions such as to ever warrant violence in a cultural or physical form. People debated and disagreed, sometimes intensely and often constantly, but it was mildly tongue-in-cheek for most people. In the vast majority of people, it was a largely enjoyable, not an angry experience. And importantly, it was an encompassing experience. The last cascading effect in this chain was the one that had the most broad, that was the most broadly consequential in society. It turns out that having an outlet for this kind of energy is actually a requirement for large-scale political stability in any primate-derived and structured society, much larger than 150 or so individuals. And how this outlet is designed is very important. It is a mechanism that can be pressed at different pressures such that people are more or less inclined to push back on broader prevailing beliefs. Basically, if people have a lot of very engaging stuff to argue about, where they can form in-groups and out-groups as they debate, they don't tend to think much beyond that and won't see or care about any of the broader dynamics at play in their lives and the world or dig any deeper into other issues. They stay within those boundaries and they are happy with what they've got. But the broader dynamics, the ones unseen or ignored, are the ones which are considerably more impact on people's world and lives. They are the stories that create the foundation of culture, the laws that govern behavior, the policies that enable economic systems, the institutions that manage daily lives, and the implicit norms that influence thoughts and beliefs, and so on. In the W, this ecosystem of intense and perpetual divergent storyline engagement massively filtered down people's appetite for engaging or making a fuss about any broader issues. Really, it was just one more mechanism that implicitly discouraged, without the need for overt or explicit action, laws, or direction, discouraged people to think critically or really think at all about the broader context of their lives because they were so highly engaged in this in-group, out-group debate. A flash of insight about this came to Cass one day while she was feeling oddly ill in a way that she had never felt before or since. In the passing of one seemingly profound moment, the following things took place. She went from being entirely unaware of these deeper dynamics to deeply knowing them, permanently and irrevocably. This made the entire context of what her content was doing and who it was really benefiting and why almost hilariously obvious to her. But the hilarity of the obviousness quickly turned into a deep and primal offense, not just about herself and her own actions, but the system that had molded and shaped her in this way and was doing this to everyone, right in front of their eyes, without their knowledge. Before this singular moment was over, Cass felt, in a strangely, deeply embedded way, a commitment to undo and set right the wrongness that was now forever undeniable. So that is one of the chapters in my book, and I hope that it has provided a little bit of interesting insight and reflection on the way that we engage with technology and how that does or doesn't affect how we engage in other things in the world. I'm going to keep the rest of my kind of commentary out for now and just end this episode at this point. If you have any thoughts about this, any reactions, any ideas, please, as always, feel free to get in touch with me. I'd love to hear about it and talk more about these things. And if this is something that's interesting to you, let me know. And perhaps I will share some more chapters from the book as I hopefully get to the point of actually finishing and getting things ready to be published. So appreciate you tuning in to this slightly different episode. And thank you for thinking about some of these really important topics and issues that face the way that we live in our world.